I always wanted to know who the best player was on tour simply because I wanted to actually work as hard. And then I ran into a little guy by the name of George Knutson out of Canada. And I watched him hit the golf ball. I watched him with the wide stance, taking the club back way inside, releasing the club. One of the greatest ball strikers I'd ever
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the McKellar Golf Podcast. The show this week has an interview with a friend of the pod, Ian Carter, author of the brand new book on the, well, title is self-explanatory, Golf Wars, about the great live disruption and all that surrounds it. It's Ian's, you'll find my, if you listen on, you'll come across my lack of research, pathetic. It's actually Ian's fifth book. I thought it was only second, but it's a really good read, available both in the UK and in United States. You can get it at all good booksellers, as we always say. Try and get one at your local bookstore, but if not, then I guess Jeff Bezos could probably do with your... be happy to take your money. Anyway, Ian Carter, Golf Wars, our friend of the pod, he will be coming up later. But first, we're going to have a quick look back at the week past and a quick look at the week ahead. We'll probably have a Masters show before it starts next week. So we'll not touch on the Masters so much, although we did a little bit with Ian. Jeff Shackelford, how are you? How's your week been? Are you looking forward to traveling to Augusta?
I am, yeah. I'm excited. The weather forecast looks good for the most part. And yeah, a lot of intrigue, I think. And I've just got to get more stuff done. You know, it always comes so quickly all of a sudden, but I'm excited and curious how the course plays. It's getting rave reviews in terms of conditioning. So that's not that it's ever... not that it's ever bad or even mediocre or so-so. Yeah, so... they treat the press very well, and it should be a lovely week.
I said we weren't going to talk about the Masters, but weather forecast, advanced weather forecast, have you looked?
Yeah, Thursday's not great, but and a little cold for the drive, chip, and putt, which seems to be a tradition. The poor kids are already nervous, and they've got to go
standing
out there.
In the pen, standing in the pen.
In the pens, 45 degrees, but... so no major rain, although Thursday, you know, we'll see. So no lightning bolts yet have appeared on the forecast. So that's what we really like to see. And it's, they've had some awful weather the last few years between cold and the violent storm last year. And of course, 2019 getting pushed up. And it never did rain that hard, but boy, they would have still had to get everybody off the property. It got ugly for a few minutes. So yeah. Hopefully that remains, and we get to actually see a really good tournament, and the course not too wet.
We are speaking on Wednesday morning. The ANWA has already started. It's been a fantastic addition to the calendar, hasn't it, ANWA?
Yeah, and I think I know that the LPGA really didn't like it, but the old Dinosaur was just wasn't a good date for it. Of course, it's the week after the Masters. We'll see how that goes. But it's very hard to get attention leading into the Masters. And then you had a few women who would play the ANWA and a few women amateurs who would play the ANA or the Dinosaur. And now all the great female amateurs are of the moment are at Augusta the way it should be. And then now the Chevron is kind of on its own. Separate of the Masters. We'll see the week after. But yeah, it's been a huge success. The only quirk that I don't still understand is why they play two rounds and then everybody goes to Augusta. When they have a dinner at Augusta, it seems like you don't have everybody play that round at Augusta and then have the dinner and then play the tournament three straight days. But, you know, I'm not going to be using my question of Chairman Ridley to try to pin him down on that in the press conference.
I was going to ask you, I wonder if anybody's ever asked. It's actually quite an interesting, because they play at the Reynolds? I can't remember what the name of the golf course is.
Champions Retreat.
Yeah, whatever it is. It's really weird. Two rounds there, obviously to set the cut and then have a day off. The only golf tournament. If you sit back and actually think about it, two rounds of a golf tournament, day off for a practice round. I mean, it's just bonkers. I mean, I guess you're Augusta National.
Well, you get away with it, but it's... But you'd think a lot of the members at Augusta would love to play that Friday before the Masters, and then they do, you know, because a lot of them work. A lot of people don't realize how many of these members they work during the week. It's incredible. It always gives me a little snicker to see these, you know, captains of industry, you know, with a notepad and making notes and looking at things and taking calls. And so you would think they would like that Friday. And then the women come over after the two rounds of Champions Retreat. And then the women play the practice day at Augusta on, that would be what, Tuesday or Wednesday?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know, Tuesday or Wednesday. Anyway, it's an odd one. I have asked and I haven't really gotten much of an answer. And I think they were, who knows, they might change it. But either way, they get the national TV spotlight on Saturday. And I think... Now, maybe because I covered the one at Bel Air, the women's amateur last summer, but it seems to me like this is the best field of the ANWAs that I can think of in terms of just notable players who have not turned pro, who are about to, not to take away from the others, but it just seems like there's several returning players, Anna Davis, we have Rachel Heck there. It feels like there are more intriguing elements to this one. And then, of course, it's just a joy to watch them play from a human set of tees, and the way the whole golf course flows and works better when they play instead of spending walking back into the, you know, no man's land.
That's the best bit, you know, for people like me. It goes back to the Masters that I grew up with, you know, those tees. And do you know what as well, Jeff, we're not going to talk about Augusta, we'll leave that for now, but early, and I know it's early, but the leaderboards, second, Hannah Darling. I go on all the time to people winning around Scottish golf and how we need a Rory. We need somebody. I'm not sure Hannah's got a Rory type of charisma and personality. Who does? But I mean, if she was to win the ANWA, that would be such a boost for golf in Scotland. I would absolutely love to see that. She's doing well. She's four under after 11. I went behind the leader. Lottie Ward as well, doing really well. So yeah, you are right. It's a great field this week. So looking forward to watching that on Saturday. I'll plank myself down in front of the TV and not leave. But again, the Masters is next week. This week we are at the Valero Texas Open. It's a pretty good field, Jeff, I think. But other than that, I mean, again, these tournaments the week before the Masters, unless it was the Houston one. Remember the good old days when they had the Houston one the week before? The golf course was set up. They actually made a virtue of setting the golf course up like Augusta National. It looked nothing like an Augusta National, but the setup was, close your eyes and try and blank out what was around about the golf course. You could have been in Augusta, but Valero Texas Open is on this week. Live Golf. Our friend of the pod, Ian Carter, is in Miami, so that'll be on this week. It'll be interested to see if Donald Trump turns up. It's at his Doral golf course. What did you think of that Doral golf course? I always thought it was awful, Jeff, but people seem to like it over the years when the PGA Tour was there.
Yeah, I never understood. I thought Gil did a nice job making what's a flat property work, and it's in its best state now. They ran into some problems with the tour, not because of Gil's work, but because a certain megalomaniac running it decided he wanted the lake's bank shaved, and the tour didn't. And of course, that first one at Doral, the greens were still new, and they had that new green firmness. The balls rolled into the lakes that, of course, the field staff anticipated because they're professionals at what they do. And we're trying to make sure the course played a certain way. But it had been meddled with so many times. I think it was just more the time of year. And it was, you come to Florida, it was the opening event in Florida. And it usually produced drama and good crowds. I don't know what they'll have for the live event and what they'll have in the way of energy out there. We know there will be music playing. But that doesn't necessarily translate to actual energy. I mean, look at Houston last week. That was... they moved from the fall to the spring, and it was I watched some of the fall ones, and the crowd energy difference was massive. Of course, having a Texan in contention was helped, and then but when he missed the putt on 18, it was just hilarious how quiet it just was. There was it wasn't like Steven Yeager had a putt to hit, but it was just they were out of there. They were just flooding out of the tents around 18. So they're kind of homers for their people. But I thought it was you looked at it, you go, that's the event now that should be played before the Masters. A combination that's of right. The way the golf course was overseeded and the way Tom Doak and Brooks Koepka redid it with more short grass. And of course you have some pretty wild greens and some greens where, God forbid, you don't get to play at the hole, that the smart play is to play away from the hole. I mean, I couldn't think of a better way to get ready for Augusta. Whereas this week, is just really tough to watch. It's just kind of this TPC in San Antonio. That's sort of soulless and narrow. It does have the bunker in the middle of the green near the end, but it's just a big, like, you just, you know, back to scale and watching the women walk Augusta, the scale of Memorial Park is a classic place, and it's a public course. It just, everything about it is fantastic. But Valero is the one that derailed the old Houston Open's place on the schedule and led to this whole mess. And they wanted that date before the Masters, and they were paying for it. And the tour just dropped. This Houston, you know, when they had sponsor issues, they couldn't wait to drop it and move it. And it's just another one of those where you just go, well, hopefully they'll see the wisdom in trying to get now that Houston's shown what it can do again, that they'll put it back in that spot. And because I think it's, if you want to play into the Masters, that's what you want to play, is a place where you can hit driver. You're not trying to hit three wood and thread a bunch of, I forgot what trees they are there. Anyway, and it's just, and a lot of guys like to play into the Masters. You know, when I interviewed Crenshaw, I went back and read, he had had horrible first round issues, and he decided to play in via green. It used to be Greensboro, which was not his tradition. And he played really well at Greensboro, and he just took it right to Augusta. So I get the mentality of that. And, I get the mentality of wanting to show up early and hang out and ease into the week too. So
the I hadn't been following the Memorial Park story, but a lot of guys and gals who I trust on this stuff, they were raving about the golf course. The guys at Fried Eggs specifically, I guess, raving about the golf course over the weekend, and it certainly showed really well. I didn't know this, Jeff, until you just mentioned it. The renovation by Tom Doak and Brooks Koepka. Really? I mean, how does that partnership work?
It was an interesting combination. But Jim Crane, I'm choosing my words carefully here. The owner of the Houston Astros, is friendly with Brooks, and they wanted a player, as I recall reading at the time, involved. And I think it was a positive because Doak's been clear in some interviews that Brooks was the one who was behind really pushing for a short par three at the 15th hole that has become a little bit of a centerpiece, really, of the whole golf course. And it was fantastic viewing. And it was a great example of, just because the pin is in a spot doesn't mean you're entitled to get to play to it, that the smart play was at the side. And Brandel did a great job trying to explain that when he was able to get a word in on the broadcast. And he was really good, by the way. I wish he was able to talk more, but in their new setup, you just disappear for a while. That's, I think, which I'm afraid is intentional, because that way they don't have to pay a lead analyst a lot of money. But he did a really nice job explaining, for those who might not have understood, why balls were being repelled from this hole location, that there were other ways to play the hole that weren't necessarily right at the pin, which is great. We love that. And by the way, what is that? That's the beauty of Augusta, is we know there are so many of those moments and places on that course where, just because the pin's in a spot, you don't go at it. And that's why first timers don't generally do too well there.
That was a brilliant little hole on the final day. Can I ask you, what do you think? I'm not going to ask you to speak for Tom Doak. So when Tom Doak gets offered that job and the owner says, by the way, you'll be working with Brooks Koepka, what goes on in the minds of architects, like, name, you know, good established architects, when they get these pros foisted upon them? Do they look at it as an opportunity? Do they think, oh shit, I've got to listen to this? I've got to put up with this. I mean, what happens?
It's probably both. but a smart architect will let them share their ideas, and good ideas will come out of it somehow. Yeah. Or it may prompt
that was a great idea.
The architect to think of something else. So yeah, no, it was. And now Brooks is not on the PGA Tour, so he can't go play the place he helped design, but that's that he was well compensated for that opportunity.
The tournament, as you say, was won by Steven Yeager. Wow, I'm trying to think of the right word. He is a closer, isn't he? My goodness, he gets a sniff and he's at it. He's obviously a fantastic player. German, my goodness, you can hardly tell listening to him speak, but a fabulous player. Did really well. I actually sat down and watched it. You talked about Scheffler missing the putt on the last. My goodness, that was an absolute howler, even by Scheffler's standards. Actually, you spoke about interviewing with Ben Crenshaw this week in the Quadrilateral. If you haven't subscribed, please do. I'd never even read this before from anybody. Crenshaw was discussing with you about the importance of quiet eyes. Great putters all have quiet eyes. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, quiet in general, but yeah, quiet eyes was what Jackie Burke had mentioned to his son, and his son was passing that on to Ben, but also just quiet in general. Even when you watch, because I went back and then started watching some great putters on YouTube clips to embed with the piece, and we kind of think of, I do, Bobby Locke or Jackie Burke, these people you heard about. I got to watch Bob Charles on the Champions Tour, so I knew his stroke was different, but you kind of always think of the old putters. I guess you see the old films and the speed isn't quite right, so they look kind of jabby and quick. But then you actually watch, like I watched an embedded Jackie Burke on 18 and the putt that he made to win the Masters. And the body's very quiet and the stroke is just so simple. It's not pure pendulum or whatever. And Bobby Locke, same thing. He takes it way inside, big close stance and draws it, but it actually, everything is very quiet, the body and all that. And I love what Ben said. It's just the great putters just tend to not be worried about how it looks to other people. They tend to be worried about what feels right. And I think that's what you see is so many of these players now, they're just trying so hard to be mechanical. And I got him going on that too. He told a great story about being on the putting green, and Jerry Barber, one of the greatest putters of all time, just hitting these long putts back and forth through everybody. And Jerry could be a little, I don't know, not gruff, but he was a character. And he'd just be, and they'd have him, yeah, Ben liked to have putting contests, which another thing guys should be doing more of instead of standing in one spot for an hour. And there goes Jerry just ramming putts through. And he said he finally asked him, and he was just trying to lengthen his stroke. I'm sure as he got a little older, he started getting shorter, whatever. And I told Ben, you know, one of the things that Clayton Kershaw does, his pre-pitching routine is so fascinating because it's so precise. But one of the things he does is he starts short tossing and then he just keeps backing up. And by the, you know, the end of this part of his warm-up before he goes to the bullpen, he's throwing as far as he possibly can. He's just extending out his arm, and other pitchers do it too. But when you watch it, you realize, yeah, you know, putting is such a thing where you get tense and you know, sometimes it probably just feels good to just kind of just let it go and just get that out. And so anyway, that was really fun. And it's a reminder that putting is still, I'm sorry, there's still an art to it. And the ones who are good putters, they may be a classic stroke, Tiger Bob Charles type stroke, but they just aren't getting caught up in mechanics, and they have a light grip, they keep their head still, their eyes are quiet, their body's quiet, and I just think a lot of people are overthinking it, and I don't know if that's the case. So I mean I know it is the case with Scheffler, but he also had a couple really good rounds statistically, at least putting wise. So
there's no question that Scheffler's putting's got a lot better. Under Phil Kenyon, good old Phil. I've personal experience of Phil and his work he does with Niall went to see Phil a couple of summers ago, and 2 weeks later almost won the British Boys. So, I mean, he is he knows what he's doing, does Mr. Kenyon, and he's doing a good job with Scheffler. But you are right. If you think about the great Aussie putters, the contemporary Aussie putters, I'm thinking of, you know, Aaron Baddeley, Greg Chalmers, these guys, Cam Smith. They're pretty quiet, you know. Yeah. And Ludwig's another one who's very quiet. You know, he'll do all his work, but as soon as he gets up to the ball, it's very still and simple. It's very simple, and it's over and done with in a very short space of time. But congrats to Steven Yeager. Seems like a very smart and including guy. Yet another name to add to the list of, you know, guys in their late 20s, early 30s. It takes, you know, people, I say it all the time. We get fooled by these once in a decade, young superstars that come through, McElroys. So when we all think, well, that's the way it's done, when really it's not. It's you get out there, you pay your dues, you get on the grind. Yeager, I've read all sorts of stuff over the last few days about how Yeager transformed his swing. He was short and high, short and right, and now it's long and straight with his driver. And he add that to, as I say, a real closer's mentality. He's a guy who looks like he might be around for a very long time. Another winner, not from the story class of AGGA superstars, Jeff, and a European grinder to add to Pavon and all the rest of them. I noticed our friend Josh Carpenter put out the viewing figures yesterday. Weren't too disastrous, were they, relative to last year?
I didn't see them. What were they?
Well, I think they were around about the same. I thought that's the sort of thing that you were on board with all the time.
I'm not on Twitter much. Yeah. I'm all in the Gusta mode. So I did not Children's Family Clinic, Houston Open, whatever it's called, numbers. Yeah. I apologize.
Anyway, I thought it was a pretty good way to spend an hour or two on a Sunday afternoon. The other one who's really interesting is Alessandro Tosti.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. He's a boy that's been in, again, I'm sure people, if you're listening to this podcast, you'll know about his recent history. He's quite a spicy one, spicy guy. Seems to enjoy getting into it. Very emotional, highly strung. Didn't he have some with set two last week with, was it Finau? I think he did.
Finau, yeah. Apparently over who was away. So I don't know. I don't know the particulars, but
Character. Yeah. There is that.
I don't have to play golf with him. That's probably why.
The thing I also did at the weekend, Jeff, I went down to Harding Park to watch the final day of the Goodwin, the Stanford's golf tournament. Always interesting going to see college golf at that level. But what was especially interesting was that numbers one and two on PGA Tour University were paired together on Saturday morning. That was Michael Thorbjornsson of Stanford and Crystal Lamprecht of Georgia Tech. Paired with a local kid, actually, a kid called Willie Walsh. Again, now played with him as a junior golfer. Good on Willie. Pepperdine, I mentioned you to Coach Hurd. He asked me to pass on his best regards. But it was such a contrast. Thorbjornsson, much more kind of classical swing, not entirely orthodox, but, you know, a recognizable golf swing. And then you have Lamprecht coming up with this lumberjack's move. I mean, it's and really, really doesn't have. I mean, I know he's obviously a great player. He won the amateur championship last year at Hillside, but it's really he doesn't really know where the ball's going, to be honest. He just gives it a good old smash and then runs after it or walks after it and finds it and tries to get it. Assuming he works from the premise that, well, if it's close to the green, I mean, he really is the apotheosis of the contemporary bomb and gouger. I mean, I'm sure he's a lovely guy, but it's certainly not my cup of tea. Not great to watch. But anyway, it was interesting. And it was the point I'm coming to, there was a substantial gallery out there, Jeff, which it was very heartening. At least 100, maybe 200 people at one point. So that was great to see. And I followed that up. Again, it was our friend Brian Keogh, Irish Golf Desk on Twitter. Every year he goes to the West of Ireland amateur in Sligo at Rossy's Point under Ben Baldwin. The great tournament won over the years by Rory McIlroy and Harry Diamond. But again, you look at Brian was posting videos and the gallery there, just fantastic. And I'm just beginning to wonder if the message is getting through on elite amateur golf and, you know, with people's frustration with how things are going in pro golf. I wonder if more and more people, we're not talking thousands of people here, but I found it quite heartening that people are gravitating towards watching amateur golf, because again, I'm walking down the fairway right behind Michael Thorpe Bjornsson. He's got, oh my goodness, he hits it. I mean, it sounds proper when he hits it. It was really a fun day out. So congrats to Georgia, won the team event, I think. I know you're, but I love this stuff. Anyway, we'll crack on. Get out to your amateur, if you're a big amateur golf event near you, go out and watch it. You'll be really into it when you get there. Kato Nakajima won on the European Tour. He's one of your favorites, Jeff, isn't he?
Well, I'm not saying mine are my favorites, but I forgot he won three times last year in Japan, so I'm a little surprised he didn't get the Masters invite. But again, he had played as an Asia Pacific Amateur winner, and it's a little late. If he'd won a few weeks ago, maybe, but probably too late now. So, but he'll be in the PGA Championship because of it.
We'll wrap up on this event, but you made a pretty good point. I don't know if it was on air, if it was Cart with Ian, but Nakajima comes off and the first thing he starts talking about is, you know,
getting that PGA Tour card.
It's what do you think is going to happen to that thing, Jeff? I mean, at some stage, the European Tour is going to have to say, hang on a minute, you know, we can't give away our 10 best players every year. This is not sustainable.
No,
and you know they might find some kind of agreement at the global home where can't have these unknown Europeans coming over and embarrassing our AGGA champions every year.
I know. I think you're right. I think the latter's more likely to happen first. Obviously, Jaeger was more of a Korn Ferry.
Yes,
he played in Europe, but his Korn Ferry game was where he really developed, it sounds like, and the ability to win. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it might start in Florida first and go, all right, enough of these guys. I mean, last week it was it looked like another European Tour leaderboard there for a while. If you took Scheffler away, it was incredible.
Great, really great.
No,
stuff.
It's entertaining. I think it's great to see, and it and it's interesting. They seem to be thriving in the weeks when the setups and the architecture are a little more unusual, and I think that just speaks to probably what they gain playing in Europe and playing different. Well, not just Europe. Obviously, the tour goes all over the place, but just seeing the world and being used to a lot of different things, and it just is. It unfortunately reinforces a little bit of the stereotype about soft Americans.
Well, it's true. I mean, it makes absolute sense. You know, if you're running around the world or whatever, playing in Asia and then playing in Australia and then playing in India, Nakajima won in India last week. Then you're going to play in Spain in March or whatever, or, you know, and then the UK and Ireland. And it makes sense that your game's going to be more rounded, more ready for all sorts of challenges when they come along, rather than, you know, running around playing, you know, the same venues in college golf every year, or in the AGGA, and beating the same people every week. Well, that's not going to do you that great in the long term. I don't think, anyway. But I think my point remains. I think it's going to be quite interesting. Somebody, somewhere, at some stage, and some meeting is going to perhaps call time on this transatlantic exchange. You know, in terms of a. I mean, it's great for us golf fans, but in terms of a kind of business, I can't imagine that either side thinks it's particularly great for them. We'll see. I think that's all we should really mention. We don't really cover it a lot, but we should. It's terrible, but Nelly Korda won for the third time. She's finally, but her performances are beginning to match her golf swing. So good for her. We shall leave it at that, Jeff. We, as I said at the start of the show, we have a friend of the pod this week, Ian Carter, who's on to talk about his new book, Golf Wars, on the whole live, fiasco, but the live saga, I'll call it that. So we will leave it at that, and yeah, we will come back next week, the two of us, and discuss the Masters. You will be on the premises by then, hopefully, and you'll be able to bring me up to date with every spit and cough of the drive, chip and putt, which is possibly my least favorite event in global golf. Anyway, Shaq, good to talk to you. Oh yeah, there you go. Bah, the kids. We'll leave it there, Shaq, and we'll hand it over to a friend of the pod, Mr. Ian Carr. Friend of the podcast, Mr. Ian Carter, golf correspondent of the BBC, but for the purposes of this interview, the author of the new book, Golf Wars, Live and Golf's Bitter Battle for Power and Identity. A couple of questions I want to ask you about that, Carts, before we get there, but I want to start with a good review in Publishers Weekly. And I wonder if you could explain this to me. This is Accidental Billionaires for Golf World. What's Accidental Billionaires? Do you know, Shaq? Does anybody know? I'm guessing it's some big, successful, well-reviewed book on Wall Street or something.
No clue.
Well, I've never heard of it.
Oh, bloody hell.
Well, it's not really the circles I move in.
No.
Right. And a propulsive account, Carter. That's pretty good, isn't it?
Is it a propulsive?
Yeah, a propulsive account of how the establishment of LIV, a professional men's golf tour, created an alternative to the PGA Tour, upending the sport. I mean, you've written, that's your second book, isn't it? You had the Ryder Cup book. Is it your second? Is it?
It's my fifth book, actually. It's my fifth book.
Well,
thanks for noticing.
Oh, come on. You write so many.
No. Well, the one that really stands out for me to have been asked to do was the book that celebrated the 150th Open, which I really, you know, was just beyond my dreams, really. It's my favorite golf tournament of them all. And to be asked to do that was incredible. And I did Monty's Manor, which was the story of Colin Montgomery's Ryder Cup career back in 2010, culminating obviously in the match at Celtic Manor. And then I did one on the 2014 Ryder Cup and then one on the majors in 2015 as well. So, but I'm not sure there'll be many more after this one.
I was going to ask how difficult this one was.
It was really difficult. It was really hard. It just weighs on your shoulders. And I think with most writing projects, and you'll know this better than me, Lawrence, and all BS aside, you were the man who inspired me to go down the book writing route with, and I've told you this before, so don't give me any of your false modesty, but For Ryan in the Soul, California Dreaming, No News at Throat Lake, let's throw them all out there. They were, I mean, if I could ever get anywhere near that kind of level of book writing, I'd be absolutely thrilled. But this, I think when you do write a book, you know the beginning, the middle and the end ordinarily. But this, as we know, is a story without end at the moment. And it pivoted massively, obviously, on June the 6th and all the different twists and turns, you know, to the extent that the book should have an index in it. There was room put there for the index. And then we had to take those pages for an epilogue because obviously John Rahm went to LIV. And so it was just, you know, constantly updating, rewriting. So it was tough, but it was fascinating. I would not claim that it is in any way an inside story. I haven't been inside the rooms when all these things have been going on, negotiations or whatever. So it's much more of a commentary and a digest of just trying to pull together. And also just to see, you know, to note the way that golf was played, particularly last year in the unique circumstances that we have at the moment.
It's not like I'm halfway through it. It's not like the Shipnock book's kind of full, you know, it's more kind of he dropping in. He's a bit of a, you know, he's sticky snout in any kind of trough, won't he? I'm not, in terms of story trough. I mean, he's one of the great kind of news hounds. But it's totally. So it's a different kind of book. It's a cracking read, though. It's just an amazing. And we were there, you know, if you think about 15 years ago, Ian, golf is just mind blowing where we are now. And it kind of captures that. And you are right, it is a kind of story without end, but you kind of have to draw the line at some point, don't you?
Yeah, and the intention was to have the arc through to the Ryder Cup. And for me, you know, the Ryder Cup shone through as this most amazing match that we always know the Ryder Cup is going to be very, very special. But for me, the match in Rome was perhaps the most special one that I've been to, because the money did raise its head, as we know, with Patrick Cantlay, and the way that the fans responded to all of that, with the hats off and all of that. But just the pure competition of it was shown to me to be more precious than it's ever been. And I know Jeff and I we've discussed it at length. In fact, I quote Jeff in the book, just talking about the levels of greed and the perception of greed that is there in the men's professional game now, which I think is a turnoff for an awful lot of people. And then to actually see these guys going at it head to head in the Ryder Cup. So that was the arc. And then, of course, the ultimate twist in the tale was that, you know, one of the great heroes of the European effort there, well, two of them, as it turned out, John Rahm and then Tyrrell Hatton, chose to go and take the money from Liv as well. So it has, to your point, Lawrence, the change in the golfing landscape is just incredible compared with where we were 15 years ago, where we were 4 years ago. But of course, it was all bubbling under the surface then, and it became apparent with, you know, PGL and all the stuff that went on there as the forerunner to Liv as well. So it's been fascinating.
The well, you're at Liv Miami this week.
I am, Doral. Yes, yeah.
This is not your first Liv event. You were at the Centurion, the first one, weren't you? I'm sure you must have been.
I was, I was there. Yeah. I was there for that, and you know, bore witness to some of the most extraordinary press conferences that I've ever seen. My big regret, actually, Lawrence, was that you weren't there, because to have had some Donegan questions flying in those press conferences just would have been gold. That was all that was missing.
The best question of all time in any golf press conference, if Putin was staging a golf tour. Who was that? That was Neil McLennan. That was
Neil McLennan at the Mirror. Yeah. Yeah. And I talked to him about that, actually, and that, you know, how that, yeah, that question, right, yeah, came, yeah, about. And you know, also bear in mind, before that, there was the fireside chat with Greg Norman, which he asked the question that yielded the well, we all make mistakes answer to the, you know, the appalling murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And you know, in that way, you know, it's refreshing, I think, and that newspaper journalists were able to be so agenda setting with such pertinent questions. And we see that less and less and less in the modern media landscape, because of the concentration on, obviously, in the States, on NFL and soccer, football, in the rest of the world, that, you know, newspapers don't put the resources in that they once did. And so those media cores are smaller and smaller and smaller. And these are the guys who ask the questions that really get into the ribs of the players. So, you know, I thought that they were questions that really help set the agenda for, you know, this term, the Gulf Wars, in many respects. They actually got to the nub of what was going on in far more ways than just the unsettling of a sport.
One more question, I'll let Shaq jump in. You're at Miami. I was just going to ask, you know, how has Liv changed in 2 years? How do you find it 2 years down the line? You're there. I mean, is there any, what are the main differences, if there are any differences at all? Or is it just a stagnating entity?
No, it doesn't feel like it's stagnating at all. I've been in a very fortunate position today to talk to a number of players, including John Rahm, and to have that level of access. I wouldn't get that if I went to a PGA Tour event, and I don't think it's stagnating. I think the fact that they signed John Rahm proves that it's not stagnating. I'm not sure quite what the end game is, but I think they have every right to feel bullish with the people that they've recruited for this year. I was talking to Cam Smith, and he said it's much harder to win a tournament this year on LIV than it was last year because the standards have risen. Now, whether it's sustainable is a completely different question, obviously. But in all honesty, I arrived in. We're talking on Wednesday morning. I arrived into Miami last night. I've had a morning here so far, but what I have found is, a very welcoming media setup. People have been extraordinarily helpful, very happy to see media coming from overseas. And from my point of view, the reason for being here was because obviously the Masters is next week. I'm heading off to Augusta at the weekend. And this is the opportunity to talk to a hell of a lot of the characters who are going to be central to the story next week, including the defending champion next week. And that's something that LIV has. Perhaps more than the PGA Tour now, because outside Rory, who are the people on the PGA Tour that you really want to hear from now? And that's the fractured nature of the game right now. And the characters, whether you like them or not, the interesting guys, a lot of them are on LIV now.
Yes, they are. And that it's really starting to show, and we're seeing it in the numbers here in the US, I think, in terms of the ratings. We'll see how the majors, it'll be really fascinating if the majors keep their ratings about the same. It will then confirm that the tour has taken a real hit losing those characters. Ian, I want to ask you, you end with the book with your Ryder Cup diary, and you have some really interesting numbers on what a triumph it was in terms of views and just intrigue and interest. And over here, a little less so. I think the time was an issue. But I'm curious where you are feeling the Ryder Cup is going with the combination of LIV and also, the rumblings we hear that the PGA Tour, and we've known this for a long time, has always it's driven them nuts that they don't own it. Where that element of the story is possibly going here in the next year or two with the actual ownership of the Ryder Cup.
I think that's central to the future. I think the importance of the Ryder Cup cannot be underestimated. And I know you guys talked about and I listened with interest in the wake of the Jay Monahan press conference at the Players, where he mentioned and referenced fans and fan base over and over and over again. Well, if the fans and the fan base are important, then going forward, the Ryder Cup cannot be compromised by the politicking that is going on in the game. The best players of America have to play the best players of Europe to satisfy what the fans want to see. And when you're seeing the PGA Tours, obviously the President's Cup is theirs, and they're saying no LIV players in the President's Cup. Well, that's a disastrous for the President's Cup in terms of attracting a fan base. That's pandering to the PGA Tour membership and those who've stayed, rather than saying, well, what do the fans want to see? How can this be the very best spectacle that it can be? So I think that the Ryder Cup, and this is right on the plate of Guy Kinnings as he takes over from Keith Pelley as boss of the PGA Tour, having been the director of the Ryder Cup, he surely has to make sure that John Rahm is in that Ryder Cup, in the way that Rory McIlroy said, Tyrrell Hatton potentially as well, and finding the mechanisms to be able to make that work is going to be central, I would have thought, to finding a route to some kind of unification and peace in our time in the game. And how that's going to manifest itself is anybody's guess. But you would think that if Yasser is talking and having an impression on the people that he was talking to, then it might be possible. But I guess the other thing to take into account is, you know, all that money that has gone in from the Strategic Sports Group. And I, you know, O-level business studies is as far as I got, which is the very basic level. And I only got a grade B as well. But it strikes me that for SSG, with their investment, to get a return on that, then the value of the PGA Tour has to rise. And there are a couple of ways that that can happen. One is to get the players that they need back playing their biggest events. And the other is to somehow acquire the Ryder Cup. And the way to do that is for the PGA Tour to buy the PGA of America. Now, I don't know if you've heard, your ears are probably closer to the ground than mine, but that's been a scenario that's been put to me by a number of people, that could be part of the end game, because then the PGA Tour would have the Ryder Cup. And so there would be an argument to say that its value has increased and therefore there's potential for return on the money that's already gone in from SSG. And I would have thought that that would be also a very attractive proposition from the Saudi side as they look to invest as well.
Yeah, no question. It seems like it's there's something there. I just don't know what. And the PGA Tour and PGA of America are very close right now. And I can make a case that it would be a positive in some ways, possibly. There's certainly, you know, just the way, as you mentioned, the President's Cup situation was handled.
I mean,
was confounding. You know, I mean, from a negotiating standpoint, why would you telegraph that right away, first of all, and then.
I don't know. I mean, look, a lot of that is my, you know, writing stuff on the back of an envelope and just trying to draw together a potential scenario. I don't know what you think, Lawrence.
Firstly, before I get to that, you mentioned your Ryder Cup, Shaq mentioned your Ryder Cup diary. I'm not going to give it away. There is a phenomenal Ludvig Åberg anecdote in your diary. I'm not giving it away. You've got to buy the book, folks. It's brilliant. if you already love Ludvig, you're going to love him even more after that. That was a good get, Kurt. So that's a little scoop. I loved that. I thought it was really good. Who knows at this stage? I mean, nobody knows. There was a meeting in the Bahamas last week. God knows, nothing came out. There was no agenda. Again, you speak to people in the business. Well, I'm like you, Karts. You know, we're just making it up as we go along, essentially. In terms of business, you know, business, billionaire business acumen. But to have a high-profile meeting like that and have no agenda, a meet and greet 9 months into negotiations, my goodness, it just sounds just ridiculous. The next Ryder Cup. Go on.
Yeah, no, sorry. Just on that meeting, here's the thing that astonishes me that no one seems to have worked out that they have, and it's happened time and time again. Whenever, you know, we've known that meetings have taken place, Delaware being another example, and it's left to the players to say what happened. You know, why at the end of that meeting is there not a strategy to say, okay, guys, right, we've had the meeting. All right, we haven't got very far, but let's make a statement. Let's say something, and not just leave it to a memo to the players that then leaks into the media. The strategy I find extraordinary in that regard, because it doesn't feel. Look, I know Jay Monahan's had a lot of criticism, and I find him a very personable guy, way more personal than Tim Fincham.
Yeah, well, that was a low bar, but yeah.
But you know, but what it just makes him seem like he's just a peripheral figure when he should be kind of driving this and driving and saying, you know, even if he just came out and said, and just appeared at the next tournament and said, look, guys. Direct your questions at me. These players give up their time for this. They're doing really valuable work, but they need to be left to prepare for this week's tournament, which is a very big event. you know, I mean, it obviously inspired Peter Malnati, but the other guys on that board have been homeless. And, you know, to the extent that Rory just, you know, packs it in because he's saying he's banging his head against the brick wall. And if he could just say, you know, we had really constructive conversations, we see a potential path forward, but this is a really tough thing to negotiate. You have no idea the things that we have to unravel and blah, 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 blah. But just give something that is coming from the tour's management rather than the players. You know, I felt really sorry for Patrick Cantlay. You know, he comes off the final round at the Players Championship. We've got wind of this meeting the following day. And, you know, he comes after signing his card and is surrounded by us saying, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Well, it shouldn't. And same thing happened to Jordan Spieth after he missed the cut on the Friday. It's just like, why is it being left to these guys?
I think the golf cognoscenti have been banging on about this for a while. You know, the lack of leadership, the terrible PR and comms. I mean, Shackelford goes on about it all, the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, the leadership may well be there, but at least show it in a public way.
Yeah,
or well, it might not be there.
Again, well, that is part of leadership, though, realizing the point that you're making. Mm. Here, I realize we've only got it for a certain amount of time. I want to, you mentioned Guy Kennings earlier on, the new head of the European Tour, DP World Tour. I want to ask you, just for an assessment on Pelly, kind of mixed. I mean, he's gone now. He thought there would be a settlement of the golf wars by the time he left, just prior to the Masters, but that obviously didn't happen. What was your view on Pelly? Good thing, bad thing? He seemed to leave with a bit of a shot or two at the PGA Tour. Did you pick that up at all? Frustration?
Yeah, I did. And I think when we spoke to him in Dubai, when it became clear that he was leaving, you know, that was the first time he was actually liberated to give a morsel to the media, because he was going, and his insistence on golf needing to be global was that was a departure from the script. And it's, you know, it's abundantly clear, and Jeff's highlighted this, I know, a million times, that it is so American-centric at the moment. And that was him saying, listen, guys, you've got to think much more internationally. I wrote a piece that sort of detailed all the things that he had to deal with and tried to explain why he could never, and I think it was an impossible job before the unique circumstances of his tenure manifested themselves. But it you know, he wanted to set up the European Tour to be a genuine rival to the PGA Tour. He used the example of Matt Fitzpatrick when he took over, saying, I want this tour to be a viable alternative to the Matt Fitzpatricks of this world. And of course, that was just impossible for all sorts of circumstances, COVID being an important one in them. And then, of course, the rise of LIV and the way that prize funds went. And my conclusion was that he probably did the best he could with the cards that were dealt him. And he was given, I think, an impossible task to try and create a European tour that could rival the PGA Tour. Just inconceivable. And I remember when he started to say it in the early part of his tenure, and he was just thinking to himself, there is no way that is going to happen, because the tour was so big. But the tour at that time, the tour was so big that you couldn't even envisage anyone saying that they would go to a rival organization, which they ultimately did with LIV. So I think he's a very canny, a very astute businessman, and his role was to service the members of his organization, and they've got guaranteed prize funds, record prize funds. That's job done, really. That they are, you know, KPIs, Keith Pelly indicators, and key performance indicators of what he had to achieve. But, you know, when I wrote that piece for the BBC Sport website, if you looked at the comments underneath, oh my God, you know, the fans, and this is, you know, essentially British golf fans, just think that the European Tour, DP World Tour's been sold down the river. It's nowhere near what it once was. And those are people looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, because we know that the biggest talent has always gone. But certainly back in the day, they found ways to keep big stars like Colin Montgomery and Lee Westwood, for the most part, playing on the European tour. And now it's impossible to envisage that, you know. And you see that, you know, Nakajima winning in India last week. First thing he says afterwards is, my ambition is to get one of these 10 cards. This is my route to the PGA Tour. And so it is a feeder tour, but it's got to find a way to celebrate that fact almost, I think, now. And if it's doing it with record prize funds and guaranteed prize money for the medium term, then that is a bit of a success. But what the long-term future is anybody's guess. And I just think it's a hell of an in-tray for Guy Kinnings coming in now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Kinnings. You've known him for a very long time, as have I. I always found him, you probably had a closer relationship. Not that any journalist has a close relationship with these guys. But he was a former head of golf for IMG in Europe. I'm most famous for being Monty's manager for a long time.
Yeah.
The long-suffering manager of Colin Montgomery, which I think he did with quite a fair amount of aplomb and good humour. What's he going to be like? I saw, maybe I misread this, but I thought Rory wasn't overly, I think he mentioned him a few weeks ago, Guy Kinnings coming in. I don't think didn't seem to me that he was overly effusive, but what would be your assessment on Kinnings? Is he pro-America? I mean, pro-America. Is he pro-PGA Tour? Is he desperate to stay by the sides of the PGA Tour? Is he the kind of guy that, because there have been rumours kicking around that DP World Tour has been speaking to the Saudis. What kind of guy is he?
He's, I think that I was talking to someone today who worked very closely with him for a very long time. And we both agreed that he is a safe pair of hands. You know, he won't do anything radical, or if he does, that would be a break from what he's done before. Really? I think he's very, very pragmatic. He's very personable. He's very charming. He, I think, has the support of most players. He knows everybody in the game from the positions that he's held. I think he's very well respected. I agree with you. I thought Rory was, you know, he held back a little bit in terms of he could have been much more effusive about the appointment. And he almost sort of hinted, well, yeah, he'd be fine for as a stopgap. I'm putting words in his mouth, but that was the kind of message that he gave back in Dubai when this all broke in January. And Rory is the key figure. Rory is the guy that he has to get on side. And we know that Rory's views have changed vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, LIV, Ryder Cup qualification, and all of that sort of thing. So that's one of the conundrums that Guy Kinnings has got to solve, because clearly, from Rory's point of view, he wants to have John Rahm in the next Ryder Cup team, and the mechanisms have to be there. And from the European Tour's point of view, they've got to have John Rahm playing at Madrid. They've got to find ways, I would say, of keeping their biggest European golfing names relevant to their tour. And that's going to be very hard to achieve while you're in a strategic alliance with the PGA Tour. And that will be a very, very hard thing to unpick, because that's what gives the DP World Tour its safety net going forward. And that's why they've got guaranteed and increased prize funds across the board. So that's a lot to gamble on doing a deal with Saudi Arabia, who many people will say to you, you know, are perfectly capable of just saying, oh, I've had enough of this now, I'm moving on to the next thing. Now, I don't know whether that's true. I you know, it's a public investment fund, and they're going to invest as they see fit rather than do what is necessarily best for golf internationally. So it's a tough old gig for him to be taking on. But he possesses a lot of the qualities that I think will be needed in terms of his standing with players and figures within the game, and his diplomatic skills.
Lawrence, did he just mention Madrid? Is that did he just give away? Is that has that been announced? Did I miss a memo?
No, I think he was talking about Spanish Open, isn't he?
No, exactly. Yeah,
oh,
Spanish
okay.
Open.
Because it's up for a Ryder Cup too, isn't the?
Oh no!
I thought we got some breaking news there.
Oh, listen, you don't get breaking news from me, Jeff. You should know that.
Darn!
Crystal ball. I want to ask you about the Masters before you leave. Very quickly, we talked about it earlier in the podcast, but I want to ask you: where are we in 1 year, 2 years' time? I mean, again, we're all guessing. I said that earlier, but where are we, do you think?
I think that the next Ryder Cup is such an imperative to have some kind of unification, whatever form that takes. I think that I just don't know, Lawrence, because I can't see anything or anyone on that player board who is really, you know, fighting. Webb Simpson said some good stuff. But, you know, it was put to me that the players are the problem. And I said to someone during the Players' Championship, who was real, real sort of high up, who's been involved in all of these negotiations, and he was basically saying, you know, the players are the problem. You know, we know a way through this, but it's convincing the players. And I said to them, we've reached this position because of the ham-fisted way in which June the 6th was handled. And that is the byproduct of it. Monaghan had to give that balance of power to the players from there on in. And it's not an international bunch of players. They're all Americans apart from Adam Scott. There's not a European on that player board. There's one European on the pack, and that's Seamus Power, who's never really played on the DP World Tour. So that's what we're dealing with at a time when anyone who rationally looks at it from an outward perspective is, you know, would say that it has to go global. We have to have a more international approach if men's professional golf is to really succeed. And I said to this guy, I said, if Jay Monahan was, or rather if Patrick Cantlay was facing a really difficult, I was just picking Cantlay out because he's on the board. If Cantlay was in a really difficult position on the golf course and had to get up and down, would he ask Jay Monahan to come in and play the bunker shot? And it almost feels like this is what we're doing. We're getting a bunch of players who, let's face it, are in it for themselves. They have a short window in the game. The long-term future of the game, as much doesn't matter how altruistic they really they might be in their soul, that is not their driving force.
Yeah.
They are about now, here, now, what can I get out of this moment in the sun that I have in my career? And these are the people who are ultimately have to be won over by whatever is decided going forward. And that is just a real nightmare scenario, I think, for the game.
Yeah. You mentioned the Ryder Cup. That's an 18 months time. It took 9 months to get a meet and greet together. In 18 months, you're not going to get a solution for the fractured world of professional golf. It's mind blowing. It's moving slowly.
But think how quickly they can move quickly. Think how quickly all that happened from Roger Devlin's first email to the framework agreement. But then it was done. It was so rushed and so badly handled that it totally backfired.
But to your point, the players weren't involved at that stage. The players were well out of it. Yeah. So, it's not. Do you want anything to finish off on Liv before I put Ian on the spot on the Masters, Shaq?
No, other than I'd love to hear is, you know, if he'll be doing a merchandise scouting report. I saw some nice new stuff from the Crushers that Charles Howell was pipping on Instagram. So I hope you'll give us a report on that at some point.
I, I saw, I've forgotten his, the name of his team now, which is bad, but I saw, I was talking to Cam Smith earlier today, and he had this sort of corduroy
Rippers.
He had a corduroy Rippers cap on. That was,
it will be interesting to see if John Rahm wears those horrible Legion 13 clothes at Augusta, or if he does something more subdued. But because I look at that, and you that'll look awful if you try to win a Masters. You can't put a green jacket on with that crap on. Anyway, go on, Lawrence.
Ian Carter, author of Golf Wars. Why does every book have to have a long subtitle? Anyway, Ian Carter, author of Golf Wars. It's as I say, a propulsive account according to Publishers Weekly, which is usually pretty stout and tough when it comes to book reviews. Also contains the best Ludwig Åberg anecdote you'll ever come across. Carts,
I think you've oversold that one.
I loved it. I love stuff like that, though. Honestly. Next week, Carts, you looking forward? I guess you will be looking forward to it. Everybody does look forward to the Masters. Predictions, I guess?
Well, That putt on the last in Houston from Scotty sort of just kind of slightly was, well, I think, yeah. But he's just so good at the moment, and none of the other big guns are really firing. I think what's going to be really interesting is to see how well the LIV players play. And, you know, I think last year they celebrated so many so almost freakish high finishes, you know, Phil Mickelson finishing runner up, but it was very much a horses for courses thing. And I think what's going to be interesting actually, and this might provide the route ultimately to some kind of reconciliation. If the LIV players, for me, there's still a big question mark whether 54 hole, no cut golf on a shotgun start basis is going to be the way for these guys to find their best golf. And yes, Brooks Koepka won the USPGA. Yes, LIV did really well in the Masters last year. But by the time we got to the US Open and the Open Championship, they weren't a factor. And if that trend continues, then that alters dynamics. When contracts come up for renewal at LIV, maybe the PGA Tour just has to ride this out if it's proven that the PGA Tour is the way to become a major winner. But if a Cam Smith or a John Rahm successfully defends, or, you know, or Joaquin Niemann, he's the one for me. Joaquin Niemann and Brooks Koepka outside the PGA Tour players, I see them as the biggest threats to Scheffler. But again, the Masters is so hard to pick. You know, sometimes they're really obvious, and then there are other times where you go, didn't see that coming. And they come in equal measure. And that's part of the beauty of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you've probably identified the right area, Carts. Whether or not the LIV guys, how do they perform? But the impact of a LIV winner would be so, on the landscape, on negotiations would be exciting. Shaq, I'll finish with Carter's session with a quick, how delighted would the green jackets be that their tour that's been talked about within the framework of, LIV golf? How do they perform if one of their guys wins? Well, what kind of impact would it have on the wider game? They would hate all that stuff, wouldn't they?
Well, we did it last year, though, in some ways. So it might actually be less extreme this year. But I think they just don't like anything that's about off-course stuff. They want it to be about the actual tournament once it begins, at least, or even early in the week. So I don't know. Speaking of, who knows what they think?
Well, they invited Niemann, didn't they?
Tough to read to. Yes, they did. Niemann. Yeah. Well, and they should. In fact, I think I'm kind of wondering why Nakajima wasn't invited now. But I'll let you ask Chairman Ridley that question. Oh, don't give me that look, Lawrence. He won three tour at times on the Japan Golf Tour, and he just won on the DP World Tour. And he was a former, but he did get an invitation before as a Asia Pacific amateur champion. So, but Hitsusuni is better. I know you're on your upside thing. Yeah, I know. We can argue about that without wasting Ian's time. He's got to go scout Doral and what the Crushers are.
Yeah, there you go. Listen, Karts, brilliant to talk to you, buddy. We'll talk to you again soon. Maybe get a game of golf over the summer when we're
back. Love to. I would love to. That was great. And thanks so much for having me on.
Then I realize it's a wide open.